So we'll go for about 35, 40 minutes, okay. And just keep it conversational. If there's anything that we say that you don't want included, we could edit it out really simply. Right.
Send me a demo after it's done.
Happy to, yeah. Happy to send you kind of the version that's unlisted version. You can review it. If there's anything you don't want, yeah, cut it out.
I kind of doubt it, but...
it happens. I've had investment bankers on the show who are like, you know, I need you to send it to me beforehand.
Compliance is not going to like that.
Yeah.
Like, I fortunately don't have a compliance department anymore.
No worries. You ready to go?
Yep.
Awesome. Today we have with us Bill Hiestand. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Really excited.
Today's episode is really interesting. It's going to be about the topic of internal succession. It's the idea of employees being able to buy out a business owner. And I think you have an interesting kind of story as to how you came across this idea. Mm-hmm. So tell us, what was kind of the genesis? How did you first learn about this idea of internal succession?
Yeah, well, actually, I lived it. I lived it young, and then I lived it still pretty young, and then I lived it older. And the deeper story is I worked with my dad for 7 years, and on his 65th birthday, he retired. And the process leading up to that, after a couple of years of working together, he said, you know, I think you should buy the business from me. And I went, what? Where's that money going to come from? And it was just a completely foreign concept to a naive young guy, and he said, just calm down. I'll just show you how it works. One of the things he taught me that I talk about in the book as well is that the business buys itself. In a small business, conceptually, the business buys itself because it's the business's cash flow that has to be used to pay for it. So that's the business buying itself. And as I got comfortable with that, I was still uncomfortable with the idea of being the sole owner. And we had a multifaceted financial services practice. We were some of the first folks in the world to write 401k plans.
Wow.
My dad heard Ted Benna, who's the father of 401k, speak at an event called the Million Dollar Roundtable in 1984. Came back and said, oh, yeah, we're going to do this. Everybody's going to want him. And no, they didn't really then, but it's funny to read financial press now, and it's about millennials saying, well, yeah, you're going to give me a 401k, but I want this and that and the other thing. It's really interesting to see. So that was blowing up, and he needed somebody to support him, which is how I got into working with him. It looked way more interesting than working at a bank branch, which is where I was. And so we recruited a partner for me who had a broader skill set in the group benefits side of our business. So we had 401ks and we had group health and welfare benefits. And then on his 65th birthday, we bought him out. And we had a really good lawyer-drafted buy-sell agreement, which is key. Because that partner decided a couple of years after that she wasn't happy and she was leaving. And the agreement spelled out, here's the business you can take, here's how you can take it, here's the rules under which you can take it. Because all of our businesses, for the most part, in business today, it's all intellectual stuff going on. And it's business relationships and it's people choosing to work with people. So it's pretty hard to lock that down unless you have an agreement that says, here's how we're going to behave. So that was really acquisition number two. Number one, buying out dad. And then number two was surviving the exit of the partner and her buying her way out of the business.
Got it. Let's take a pause for a second so they can do whatever they're doing outside.
Creaking.
Let's drag these tables across this concrete floor.
You can see them.
They don't normally do this. And this is there, this is a soundproof room. At least there's this is all soundproofing.
Yeah. Until it's actually, you know.
I'm wondering where they're doing it. If it's
they're actually there, you can see the chairs moving right outside the door. They're moving
the
some
door
metal, they're moving some metal tables. Yeah. The other door, the outer door is open.
Oh, okay. I think they might be done. All right, I think they're done.
Okay.
All right, let's resume. I'm going to close that door.
Yeah, okay.
It's actually over there, not right here. I think they're done though.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah. They're not done. But wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more. Okay, now we can resume.
Okay.
So your reaction when your father said you should buy out our business was probably the same reaction most employees would have when if their boss approached them with that same kind of proposition.
Yeah, I think so.
So what's the next step? Like when you said, how do I do this? What did your dad recommend?
He worked with me, and we went through a process of forming a partnership and doing the legal corporate structural work. And it was a process. It was took 5 years from the time he suggested it. He let it lay for probably 6 months before he brought it up again, because he knew I was just freaked out by the idea. And then he came back to it, and we began working on it. And gradually it grew on me that it could happen. This whole concept of the business buying itself really resonated with me. That because I, what it said to me was, I don't have to have some big checkbook somewhere, which I didn't have. What young person does? Almost none. In fact, what person does? Almost none. So the business, though, has a checkbook that regularly gets filled up. And it's the source of the capital. And as he taught me about that, and he let me run the books of the business for the couple of years prior to his leaving, so I actually understood the money coming in, the money going out, what that whole process looked like and felt like. Because in I think most businesses, my experience, cash flow is what I call lumpy. Sometimes big chunk comes in, and then sometimes not much comes in for a while, and you have to learn how to smooth that out, because the payroll isn't lumpy. It's the same number just about every month. The rent isn't lumpy. All of that, all the ordinary expenses of the business aren't. Revenue is uneven, so you have to learn how to work with that, and that was part of the educational process for him to show me. When it's a person who isn't related, that was my dad and me, so that's more common. When it's a person who isn't related to the owner basically has to get over their idea that this is all a secret. Eventually, if this person's going to buy you out, they're going to know how much you make. And if they're really worth being your successor, it's not going to bother them that you make more than them. It's one of those duh factors in business. Yeah, the owner, founder, or leader of the business almost always makes more, unless there's a heavy sales element, and then the sales commissions can override the leader's pay. But that's not that common.
Got it. So yeah. It sounds like what this is structured as is basically transitioning some cash flow over to your father, additional cash flow over to your father, basically, mm-hmm. In a way that buys him out. But who ends up with that equity, essentially? Is it an actual purchase of equity, or is it just, you know, kind of increased salary? How is the cap table structured after this transaction is complete?
Mm-hmm. There are going to be other people with a broader financial and M&A skill set that I think can address that more completely. What I'll tell you is from my experience in the intellectual relationship type of business, there really aren't any assets. There are liabilities, excuse me, but there really aren't any assets, except for the fact that you have these relationships that if you can maintain them, the asset is that people hate, that is your customers, your clients, hate to change. They hate worse to fire somebody. And so if you're any good at all, they're not going to leave you and they're not going to fire you. If it's a bigger money ticket item, they'll more readily get over that. And when I say that, what I mean is, for example, a health benefit plan where the premium is a couple hundred thousand a year and somebody else comes in with a smarter pitch than the ideas you've been using, they will fire you pretty readily. Because there's big money on the table. A small business, 25 people, that's a lot of cash. But in other aspects, they people like relationships and they like the steadiness. So that's the asset. The cash flow is really the thing that makes the business continue to go. It's what makes the business valuable. It is in that kind of business that we're talking about, the valuation formula is all about cash flow and the historical revenue. In financial services, wealth management and employee benefits, where it's not a transactional kind of business. So I'm not talking about transactional kind of business, which are much harder to value. There's a steadiness to the cash flow that's an observable, easily documentable fact. And a multiple of cash flow is what the norm is there. And in financial services, it's somewhere between 2 and 3 times cash flow. So that's an easy thing. Now, the junior partner, which is what I was and what my successors were when I retired, is they're in a position to get a nice pay raise, and I'm in a position to get a paycheck for a really nice long period of time. That's something that a lot of people in the M&A world can't quite get their head around. And that's because if you think of an IPO, you get cashed out by somebody else with somebody else's money, and the seller gets a nice, huge check and probably retains some stock, often does. In an intellectual property kind of business, that's really not the way it works. But a lot of people are stuck on the idea of what I call the angel buyer, kind of like an angel investor. But angel investors are in it, and the kind of targets that they're after are really a unique set of the business world. They're looking for something that can multiply their cash investment in 3 to 5 years and that they can be out, in and out quick. Well, a regular business, the owner, the boss, the employees, they're doing it year in, year out, for a long time. That's what those relationships are built on. I keep showing up 5 years later. I'm still showing up. I'm still doing what you expect me to do. I'm doing more, adding more value, and you the buyer like that. So the relationship continues. That's a whole different thing. And so that's how the valuation and the asset based part of the transaction, the asset is considered the cash flow. And the rest of the desks and stuff, they're almost worthless. You know, once you buy a desk, even if you paid the office supply a couple thousand bucks for it, it becomes worth 10. So, you know, you put a number on it and you put a number on some of the computers, which are almost always out of date and worthless. But what's really valuable is the relationships and the intellectual property style, which means in a financial services business, for example, there's a way that we approached retirement plan consulting and health and welfare consulting was just different than everybody else because it was invented by us. Now, it didn't mean we had different products. Everybody has Blue Cross, but it's in the way, and this is especially pre-Affordable Care Act, we could be really creative in the way we put together a health and welfare plan to help the employer save money and still give the employees a great benefit experience. So it's that kind of stuff, and it's still possible in the 401k world and in other parts of financial services. You can be really creative and different than everybody else. So that's an asset. But it's pretty much like we joked when we were in the business of meeting with clients, we're selling air. They're buying what is, you can't put a, it's not a thing. It's what we know. It's what we can do for them. That's what they're buying.
Would you say that there's certain types of businesses that this works for or works better for than others?
Well, here's the interesting thing to me. This is so unusual because the typical business owner, so let's talk about a couple of foundational kind of facts that I learned as I was working on this. I knew this just intuitively because that's how come all of my clients are 10 employees? Well, guess what? The average, so if you take out public companies and you take out the giant privately held companies and then you have the rest of them, the average for the 5 million private companies in the U.S. is 10 employees. Doesn't mean there aren't some 1,000-employee companies. Doesn't mean there aren't some 100-employee companies. But the average employment is 10. A 10-employee company is just a whole different animal than everything else. Once you get to a revenue stream of $3, $4 million and you have an employment base of 20 or more employees, an external buyer is a very likely story for you. Once you get below that, and this is where the angel buyer problem comes up. The owner thinks somebody's going to come and write them a check for $1 million. And then what? They're going to go, they have $1 million in their pocket and they're going to go run this little company? No, they're not. That's where the problem comes in for most small companies. So the owner keeps hanging around waiting for that $1 million check, and then they're 70, and then they're 75, and then they can't run, then they fall apart, and then the company falls apart and it goes away. And so in the statistics that can be garnered, which I've seen in Australian press, I've seen in the UK press, and I've seen in the United States press, and I've seen in Canadian press and other like business broker associations, 7 in 10 small businesses don't sell. So where do they go? Poof. They cease to exist. Why? Because they keep expecting that $1 million check and they're never going to get it. And in the process that my dad taught me and that I facilitated in my company, if you mentor your buyer. Another friend of mine who I met in the process of writing this book is a Canadian former attorney who decided this niche is something he wanted to do. He wrote a book called Hire Your Buyer. His name is John Mill. It's an interesting point of view. That's really what the small business world needs to migrate to, is if you hire your buyer and you mentor them, when it comes time to retire, here's my experience. I spent the 5 years before I retired and sold the business seriously focused on becoming irrelevant, which is really hard to do because the business was about me, right? And to stop and it had my name on the door, the He Stand Company. But what I knew was that if I was the centerpiece of everything, and I still was at a lot of the meetings, but if I was the person the clients would only talk to, I could never sell it. There was nothing to sell. So they had to be attached to and willing to see the other person as the person. And so when it came time for me to leave, we didn't have to go around to all the clients and say, hey, I'm retiring, and I hope you'll trust Mary and Candy to run the business because I'm going to sell it to them. We didn't have to go through any of that. I just left. We had 6 months later, they put on kind of a celebration party for their new business and invited me and another fellow who was part of the equation to the meeting to kind of say, and thanks to Roger and Bill, see you guys later. And everybody was kind of like, yeah, we knew it was really Candy and Mary that we were dealing with anyway. So, yeah. And those guys were getting older and they should bail out. So
how does one arrive at a valuation?
Well, there's so many different kind of businesses that you in your industry, that's the first place you have to look is what do other businesses in your industry sell for? So ideally there are valuation folks or M&A consultants that really do your industry because it's so, excuse me, it's so unique. For many, many years, my CPA told me, because this is the way CPAs do it, you're going to get one times. Well, then I met a company that does RIA, Registered Investment Advisor, financial services practices, and they said, no, it's two to three times. This is what the number is. Listening to some other business broker podcasts, they say two times. That's kind of their mantra, two times. And it's all about earnings. How you calculate the earnings starts to get complicated in businesses that are in some way involved with stuff. If you have inventory or you create inventory, the valuation process there is completely different than if you're just dealing with intellectual property. I think intellectual property is pretty easy. It's how much money are you generating and how steady is it and how non-transactional is it? If it's transactional, then it does require a personality to always be closing. The selling mantra, right? Always be closing. Well, that's harder because that money doesn't show up next week unless you have established some kind of reputation. We take just for overly simplistic, a Dell computer. Well, they're Dell. So they are transactional, but people come back to them because they're Dell. There's other competitors to that went away. Gateway was one. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it was around in the 80s and 90s. Pretty serious. And when Dell was first starting out, it was like Gateway and who's Dell? Well, now they're gone and it's all about Dell. So they have a following because they are an identified brand. Most small businesses, the ones that I really wrote this book towards, the small businesses are the average 10 employee company, and that it just they're not even big enough to be known outside of their clientele. You're who? That's even after my dad started our company in 1979, and still in 2015, people were like, "You're who?" Because we were just tiny.
Yeah.
So we didn't have a brand. We had to prove what it is we knew and what it is we could do for a client.
What's it like? How is negotiation different in this internal succession versus traditional M&A? Like traditional M&A, you're negotiating with an external party.
Mm-hmm.
With internal succession, you're negotiating with essentially yourself or your own employees.
Yeah. Both,
so,
really.
Yeah. So how is that process of negotiation different?
It's gonna be unique to each person, but and each company. But I think the first place it has to start is with the owner to negotiate with themselves and their life partner, their husband, wife, or significant other. That I want to do this, and it's gonna be. There isn't any big check that's coming in the door. We're going to get paid over a period of years, because if we're too piggy, we're going to bankrupt the business and we're not going to get paid anything, a couple of years worth. If we're too generous, we're not going to have enough money to live on. So we have to find the right balance. That takes a lot of time and thinking it through. And then you have to find your right succession partner. And this is something that the person, Mary, who bought the business from me, isn't the first person I had in mind. I kissed quite a few frogs, and it's like dating. They looks pretty good. It sounds pretty good. And then you're dating for a while, and you go, oh, no, this is not good. So it takes time and patience, which is why the entrepreneur owner who is starting to think about it at 60, that's late. They really need to start thinking in your early 50s that when I get 65, I want to be out of here. Well, so how long is it going to take? Well, I better know who my successor is going to be early enough that I have time to really vet them, know them in a way, because what's the essential component to this? It's a trust transaction. None of the successors are going to come with a big pot of capital. They have youth and energy and creative thinking and a real desire to prove it themselves and to really make it happen themselves. And when you're the owner, it's inevitable you get more money. And when the former owner gets paid off, you get more money, or you have more cash flow to start doing some of those things that you really wanted to do, but for another $50,000 that you'd like to have, or another $100,000 you'd like to have. So it's a process of trust. Well, it takes time to know whether this is, and that's the kissing frogs part. Can I really trust this person? Well, you can't find that out in 2 years. If anybody who's listening has been married for any period of time, you don't even know who you married for at least 5 years. Everybody, it's still a honeymoon. Even after the second year, you're starting to get know the person, but after five, you really know who you're dealing with. So it takes time.
So let's put some actionable steps in place. So if someone is a business owner thinking of transitioning out of their business and they're interested in pursuing an internal succession exit plan, what's the first step? What's the second step? What's the third step?
Yeah. And the reason I wrote the book is because those are not part of the common business language yet. The way I see it is the book will be bought as much by the business owner looking at their potential successor and saying, he or she might have it. I wonder if they do. Boss gives the person the book and says, you know, I see some potential in you, and I'm not making any promises here, but why don't you read this book and tell me what you think? And don't say, the way I think of it is, don't say much more. I'm thinking of selling you the business and blah. Just give them the book and see if they come back. Because I wrote the book as much as a personal growth kind of book than I did some sort of lawyerly transactional tome. There's almost none of that in there. I have one chapter that kind of lays out how this process works. Mostly it's a zero down payment kind of event. Maybe if the business has the ability to prove it and the potential buyer does, you could get a bank to lend some down payment money, and maybe there's a, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 initial payment. But in small companies, that's a big number. They almost no small companies just, you know, have an extra number of zeros to throw around anywhere. So that's the first side of it. The other side of it is a person who thinks, man, I'd like to own a business, and this one would be good. I wonder if I could buy this business. Ideally, they will find it by searching or be referred to it by somebody. If it becomes viral, that would be awesome. People would say, well, you got to read The Ownership Ladder. That's the book. It's those two ways, from my point of view, that really can have an impact to get the conversation started. Then the two of them can, from a knowledgeable and intentional point of view, start interacting with folks like your firm and get some real insight into how do we structure the transaction. Because every business is so unique. Every situation is so different. You can't just say, well, they all should go. My payment scheme is quite long. And my dad's was. And how did we get to that? We said, well, if every month we have to write a check for that amount, what's going to happen to the business in the months when it's not a big pay month? And if there's two or three of those in a row, what's going to happen? Can the business still pay the working boss and pay the former owner? And that's as much the equation of how long should it take. The number as to how much should it cost, that was when I bought it from Dad, we had to use, we went to the business valuation books because also nobody knew how to sell that we were three people at that time, a tiny financial services business of our type. It's like, you sell 401ks? What are those? And you sell health insurance? Well, okay, that's insurance. But really, we had to go to the M&A books and read about different valuation formulas and come up with a spreadsheet. Fortunately, this was, tells you how old I am, this Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet. This was before Excel even was invented. So, but nowadays it's more known and people are more comfortable, I think, with a multiple of some kind of cash flow. And you got to look at the cash flow different ways, but that's the way.
Yeah. Typical M&A processes are like, you know, I've seen anywhere from 3 months to 9 months. What's the typical...
To come to an agreement?
No, to actually go through the entire process. Uh-huh. So a company looking to sell engages a broker or banker, and they look for potential acquirers, or they get an unsolicited offer from a potential acquirer, and they go through the process of term sheets, negotiation, due diligence, closing. Yeah. And that whole process is on average about 6 months. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience with internal succession? How long does that typically take?
Well, I've only been through my own, so they are longer because everybody has to get comfortable with the idea.
Yeah.
And because then the successor and the seller do become legal opposing parties. So guess what? We both have to have legal counsel. But guess what? Who has the checkbook? Well, me, the owner. So I'm going to pay both sides. And then there's that inevitable sort of competitive conversation that just is going to happen, gets expensive. And our idea was I was going to work till 70. I'm 63, almost 64. Well, as soon as the ink was dry, two things happened. We had a sales call on a new 401k prospect. They hired us. They loved us. We started implementing all the stuff, and we were sitting with the HR and said, well, you know, we can handle your health and welfare. And she said, no. We said, yeah, we do that. And she said, no, you're never going to do that for us because we love Roger and Candy. We said, oh, okay. She said, but, you know, he's not getting any younger. Maybe you should talk to him. And so I did. Portland is where I came from, Portland, Oregon. It's a small town. Everybody in industries knows pretty much everybody else, so I knew who Roger was. Took him out to lunch, and he said, yeah, I've been thinking about doing that. I just have never really known how to do it. And I said, well, why don't we see if we can put the two firms together? And so I went back and said to Mary, you need to take Candy out to lunch. If you don't like each other, there's no point in having any further conversation because we're not going to get two people who don't like each other married, because that's what happens. The two younger parties become partners. Mm-hmm. Well, they just hit it off. And just suddenly they were having coffees and drinks and lunches and who knows, you know, they were having all of these conversations. And at about the same time, I realized that the idea of working to 70 was a good intellectual process, but the idea of doing it actually wasn't all that intriguing. And because I had spent, I talked earlier about spending time consciously making myself irrelevant. Well, guess what? I was. Yeah. I was irrelevant to the business, and I had to get out of the way. So the initial thing, I actually bought an RV, and my family and I drove from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine to San Diego for 60 days. And I didn't think about it or do anything about it except some worries. And they were probably going, what the heck is he doing? Because I wasn't talking about it. But when I came back, I was ready. And I said, you know, let's do this. And so that was early September. And by the end of the year, the first of the next year, we closed.
One question I ask all my guests on the show is, when is the right time to sell?
So I'm going to answer this as advice to the small business owner. Do it way sooner than you think. Find a good successor and get out of the way, because 7 out of 10 of you are going to blow it up and you're going to have nothing. I mean, I've spoken on this just at a few Toastmasters meetings 3 or 4 times. Every time somebody comes up to me and says, oh, I wish my dad had your book. He's now in the hospital, and my mom doesn't know what to do with the company, and we're having a hard time keeping the employees, and I think it's just going to go away. Happens all the time, and that's just dad has to get and mom have to get to the point of saying, you know what, I'm 55, I better get serious about the exit plan, because it's going to take some time. And it is, and they got to get serious about that reality that there's no angel buyers out there. Maybe they're, and I will say, if there are 25 or more people and they have a pretty good niche and they have a good revenue stream, yeah, an angel buyer will come along. There's somebody who's in a consolidation mode almost always these days. They're probably from out of the area. I saw my clients from Japanese, Swiss, Canadians, New Yorkers, Californians. It was never an Oregonian with a big checkbook. It just was a, But in Texas, it might be, because that's where we are now. In Texas, it might be different. But
let's look at the other side of the equation. When is the right time for an employee who's thinking of, who thinks to themselves, I could run this?
Mm-hmm.
When is the right time for them to engage, engage the owner in this topic?
I came across this concept as I was writing the book, and I was struggling with generations and the whole generational label thing, and I realized that they phase out so quickly, and they're really not applicable. A friend of mine, we were just joking about it, and he said, well, you know, when you think of the baby boomers, the first of them were burning their draft cards. And the middle of them were dropping out, and the later ones were burning disco or rock and roll records because it was the disco era. I mean, a generation doesn't really describe people. So what does? And it occurred to me that life is really starts in 12-year segments. And why do I think that? Because you end fifth grade just before you turn 12, and then you join middle school. But middle school and high school and really college, they're just a progression of the same thing. So there's another 12 years, and you're now 24. Now you're ready to start your career. The next 12 years, you're 36, and that's the answer to your question is somewhere in that middle 30s range is when if you've worked for 10 or 12 years, you know how things work in businesses in terms of, because it's mostly how you work with other people. Some people are really hard to work with, and some people are really easy to work with. Some people you never want to work with, and some people you'd love to work with. And you can't just know that coming out of college. It's just not, it's not a knowable thing. You have to experience interactions. You have to experience people doing some pretty rotten things to you. You have to experience getting fired or getting promoted, people thinking you're awesome, people thinking you're not awesome. And also, by the time you're in your mid-30s, you have some obligations in life. And from a seller's point of view, who is the best buyer? Somebody who's, they cannot afford to screw it up. And that's the other part of structuring the deal. If I'm too piggy, then their loss to screw it up is not that big of a deal. But if it's the just right pricing of the valuation and financing of the deal leaves them so that the cost to them blowing it is so huge to their family and their kids and the house they want to live in and the community they want to be part of, well, none of that really becomes that meaningful until your middle 30s. Some people get married right out of college and they get into that lifestyle, but most of us don't. We like to have some, you know, wild times after college. I moved to Hawaii, you know, opened a health food store. There was, you know, there's just other things that looked like the fun, right?
But that's awesome.
You have to get serious eventually.
Where can people go to learn more about your book?
The book is on Amazon.com. It's The Ownership Ladder, How a Smart Employee Can Buy Out the Boss. TheOwnershipLadder.com is my website. It is not a restatement of the book. It has some really useful tools. I spent a couple of weeks doing Google searches and of every concept that I could think of and that Google suggested, you know, in the middle of the page and the bottom of the page, they say other people are asking about. So I did everything about internal succession, M&A, and I have a list of search links on my website, 547 of them.
Wow.
So you look through and they're well labeled because it's what the search term brought up. I mean, there's every time you put in a search, there's millions of stuff. But the first page is the good stuff. So there isn't that much duplication. Some of them lead to a similar alley. But most of them are helpful in that you can scan through them and just click through and learn about the whole subject of whether it's valuation you want to think about or whether it's any other aspect of the deal. So that's what I set out to do. The other thing I'm building out now is there aren't that many people who've written books in this internal succession mentality. Most of the books are written by legal folks or M&A experts, and they're really talking about the bigger deals. One of the other things I learned in this process is that that Stanford and Harvard MBA programs have three tiers. Get you ready to be the startup M&A kind of person. Get you ready to be a senior executive in a big firm. And the third is understand that small businesses have really great hidden value, and that is a really valid third track. And I think more business schools are going to start realizing that, because the sheer numbers, there aren't that many Elon Musks out there. They come along pretty regularly, but they do some things and some people get to invest in them. But most companies are not public. And most companies don't have external investments. They're all these small internal organizations. So how do you get into those? Well, I think that's a channel that should be exploited, and that's my contribution to that is this book, Ownership Ladder.
Awesome. Bill, thank you so much again for your time today.
I really appreciate it. It's been a gas.
Very cool.
Had a good time.
Perfect.
Thank you.
This is great. I'll be processing the video over the next few days.
Okay.
Plan to release it probably sometime next week. I kind of have a backlog. Thanksgiving threw me off.
Yeah.
So we were here, and then it was a couple days before that, my wife's birthday, went to San Antonio, and so I have all this backlog of videos from like the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
But this is awesome. This is like, no one talks about this. I've never heard of this. So
that's great.
Yeah, I'm very appreciative for you coming
on
the show.
And who's your? I should have asked this at the beginning. Who is the audience?
The audience is really my network. So I have close to 3,000 connections, mostly here in Austin, mm-hmm. primarily consisting of business owners,
mm-hmm.
But also probably 2/3 are business owners, the other third are investors of some sort or another, whether they're angel investors, venture investors, or private equity investors.
Yeah.
But the big chunk are like, owner, founder, operator. Of either tech startups or small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So this is great.
And
some of my videos have gotten like upwards of like 6,000 impressions just on LinkedIn alone. So
nice.
Yeah, I'm very, very grateful. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, I'm glad we found each other on LinkedIn.
Yeah. Yeah, this is super cool.
This is my second LinkedIn podcast, and then friend I made at Toastmasters.
Yeah,
he actually runs an RIA
uh-huh.
Consulting company.
Yeah,
here in Austin.
Yeah,
and so he had me on his podcast for his network.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
I did Toastmasters for a little bit. Say it back.